You're listening to Getting Lit with Linda Mora, the podcast where we welcome you to get lit. Canadian lit, that is. Join Linda as she talks about authors in Canada and sometimes with them, using her expertise to shed some light on recent and not so recent writers. And now, get ready for Getting Lit with Linda.
Hi, this is Linda Mora, the writer and host of Getting Lit with Linda. I have a question for you to think about today, my dear listeners. How do you deal with pain? I had this conversation with my friend and poet, Chantal Lavoie, recently when we were discussing when and why we swear. And yes, I do occasionally swear in moments of anger or frustration and defensiveness or shock. I read somewhere, I told her, that swearing helps us to endure or manage suffering. I wanted to be sure that I wasn't making this up, so I researched it, a la Google, and lo and behold, it's true. Studies do show that cursing can reduce the perception of pain, producing, I'm quoting here, a measurable analgesic effect by as much as about 33%. That's one way I deal with it. But it's different when I see other people in pain. I remember a few years ago seeing my beloved 7-year-old nephew who was hurting. Something was bothering him, but I don't know what. He wouldn't say. So all I could think to do was to take a pen and draw a mouth and googly eyes on my thumb and index finger, and then I made up a hand puppet with which I teased him until he started to smile, then giggled, then positively howled with laughter. I could feel the tension and pain ebb from his body. The more he laughed, the more he relaxed. So sure, swearing is one way of alleviating pain, but comedy or humor is another. It's a technique that I'm very, very far from mastering, I regret to say. But I think its use is both an analgesic and healing when used well. It delights us while offering insight and correctives. Enter Michael V. Smith and his poetry collection, Queers Like Me, about which we speak in this episode. Smith's poems inhabit that interstitial space between pain and humor, between shame and self-understanding. This is not his only work. It is the one that we focus on in this particular episode. He's an interdisciplinary artist working as a writer, a filmmaker, and a performance artist. He has several books to his credit, including Bad Ideas, published by Knightwood Editions in 2017, his novel Cumberland, which was published by Cormorant Books and shortlisted for the Amazon Books in Canada First Novel Prize in 2002, and My Body Is Yours, Smith's memoir of growing up queer and femme, published by Arsenal and shortlisted for a Lambda Literary Award in 2015. He also has a film out called The Floating Man, which we do discuss in this particular episode. Please note that I do make a mistake in this episode with a word. I say book when I actually mean bike around the 25-minute mark. He's asked by his uncle to take apart his bike, not his book. And then the poem explores what happens next after he follows his uncle's instructions. There are these teachable moments throughout, and I don't mean teachable for Michael as a young boy, but teachable for us as readers and listeners. And Michael explains why these moments are important for all involved. You'll remember that in the last episode, I introduced you to Eloise Marseille and her exploration of the journey toward radical self-love and self-acceptance. Smith's poetry collection also works along similar lines. While Marseille talked about radical self-love, Smith speaks about the importance of radical self-inclusion. And he's committed to challenging the attitudes of those who have been bullies, those who have exercised a kind of cruelty that cannot be ignored. Smith's seemingly whimsical irony and humor destabilize that cruelty while offering insight and compassion deftly, with a lightness of touch and a signature voice. I found myself laughing and wincing at the same time as he mapped out how he dealt with pain. Well, this is my interview with Michael V. Smith. Hi, Michael, and welcome to Getting Lit with Linda.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you here. You're here all the way from the West Coast, sitting with me in Montreal. And so I'm especially grateful that we have this opportunity to do it on site together. Thank you for coming. I wanted to start with the fact that you teach creative writing at UBC Okanagan and that you are a creative writer. So I have two questions to start us off.
Okay.
Is there a difference between being a creator and a professor? And if you had to write a book report about your book, Queers Like Me, what would it say about it?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I haven't had that one before. It's funny, right? Because I think all kinds of writing are creative, obviously. You're pulling language out of somewhere. And I sort of have the same idea about genre, that the genres are just a kind of stereotype or a sort of clustering of approaches or devices. So you play with the line length in poetry, and you don't really do that in other genres. And so the look of the form, for example, kind of helps us recognize what a poem is. There's more metaphor in poems. There's more maybe ellipsis in a poem than in other things. And I think maybe the same might be said about a book report. Like, you're definitely inventing ideas, but you're relying on a kind of analysis or a way of reading that you might not use to quite the same extreme or intensity as if you were generating something. Because I definitely use analysis in order to make my work better and to understand what my work is doing. But that's maybe not the primary tool that I lean on. So that's sort of an indirect answer. Yes, it's different, but I think it's only different in the degree to which we're relying on a set of skills.
Okay. And what would that book report say?
Oh, geez. That's you're trying to trap me in a brag.
I think it's fair for you to brag about this poetry collection. I think it's so wonderful. It's so good. So we're going to get into it shortly, but I'd like to hear what you thought a book report might say.
Well, I think the most interesting things about this book aren't obvious on the surface. I'm always interested in how we find a poem or how we find language that becomes a poem. So I'm always looking at new ways of generating language. And I don't think you see that in what ends up on the page necessarily. So, for example, in Queers Like Me, the first poem is 58 pages, and I made that through a storytelling show that I did when the pandemic hit. Everything closed down, and I had this idea to do a live storytelling show, and it just seemed like good timing. I thought, well, what else am I going to do with my time? And I also wanted to just help people who were, you know, kind of trapped at home. So I started a storytelling show. I did it live at 7 o'clock every night on YouTube, and the archive is there on my YouTube page. And then after maybe a year later, I transcribed two of those stories and I merged them together and I made a verbatim poem. So it's more or less a transcription with a bit of editing. So I think that's a very interesting way of making, because usually we write the poem and then we perform it. But in a way, you could say that I performed the poem and then I wrote it, or at least I shaped it and edited it.
And then perform it again when you read it.
And then I perform it again. So in a way, it becomes a script of a prior performance. I also have another tool that I use that's maybe a little unconventional. I took a whole bunch of Facebook statuses from my father and myself to make this poem called Facebook that kind of charts my father's death. So there are two different voices on a page, and one of them's mine, and they're literally just my Facebook statuses, and I did a tiny little bit of editing on them, and I chose a bunch from my dad, and those are following the two different narratives of his death, mine, which is kind of clear about what's happening, and his, which barely references it. And so, you know, that is also a kind of, I guess I wrote it. I certainly wrote my status updates and I borrowed my father's and I shaped the poem. I decided what went in what order because I had to jumble my dad's a little bit because the timelines weren't one to one because he posted so seldom, but whatever. So I'm always interested in ways that you can find a poem. And so I think that's the most interesting thing about this book in some ways, that these are very intimate personal poems about a person's life. And they drew on unconventional means or approaches in order to generate the poem itself.
Well, that Facebook poem to which you're referring is interesting to me because it also charts this kind of disjunction between experience.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that poem captures a bit of class difference. My dad was still a blue-collar white guy who worked in a mill, or he wasn't working in a mill during the status, but that's what he did for a living. Mm. And then I became, I moved to the big city and I came out as a gay guy. And I think that had a real, that there was real upward mobility for me that went along with, so it was a queer climb and a class climb kind of went hand in hand. Mm. And became a university professor. I was the first person in my family to go to university. So I'm sort of looking at the difference in what we're willing to talk about. Like it's also an exercise, not just in class, but in also two approaches to masculinity, two approaches to what privacy is, two approaches to tenderness or vulnerability. Like I'm asking for a lot of help in my status updates and my father's asking for no help whatsoever.
Yes.
And he's the one who really needs it. I'm just trying to deal with his demise, but he has nobody helping him deal with his own, or at least outside of my sister and what little I could do at a distance, he didn't really have anybody around him and he wasn't asking anyone either.
That's because he had inherited a certain form of masculinity. This is an interview that's going in a tangent I didn't expect, but let's go with it. He's inherited a certain form of masculinity that inhibits him, that prevents him from asking for help, because to do so would be to mitigate the masculinity that he thinks defines him, would
right.
you say?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Those are a kind of stoicism that meant that you were strong. And, you know, whereas I think vulnerability is a sign of real strength.
I would agree.
It's that weird, I don't know, perspective or ideology that people feed you, that this idea that masculinity is about a retreat rather than generosity.
That individual solipsism, living in a kind of silo. No man is an island.
Right. Right?
Living as an island is a sign of strength or something.
Yeah, I know. It's so backwards.
it's certainly counterintuitive is what I think. I wanted to zip back just to make sure that we included a reference to your film, which just came out fairly recently, The Floating Man, because I think it also ties in to what we're discussing right now.
For sure.
If that's okay. So I'd like to focus on Queers Like Me for the episode, but I do think we should talk about that. Could you start by telling us a little bit about the film? I've only been able to catch a glimpse. I saw the previews online. I'm going to put a clip in my show notes for listeners so they can go and see it. Who or what is The Floating Man?
Yeah, it's a documentary experimental film, I guess. It's pretty easy to follow the narrative, but it has three main threads in it. And the whole work is about me. I've collected all of the performance work, photography projects, short video projects that I've made, and then generated some new material. And it's mostly a look at my relationship to masculinity and how art was a gateway drug to explore a genderqueer experience, essentially. The film's modeled off of Agnès Varda.
Okay.
I don't know if you know much about her, but
no.
She was part of the French New Wave. And she made all of these really lovely, in her later life, she made a lot, well, in the last half, she had a long life. She made all these really lovely documentaries where she kind of picks a topic and she becomes the host of that topic. And they feel quite improvisatory. They sort of take tangents. She'll go to her family home to see who's living there just because she's talking about her growing up in this small town. And then a man who lives there is interested in trains and she follows him and sees what he has to say about trains. And So she's makes these really unusual, loose documentaries around a topic or an idea. They're kind of like a complex video poem essay.
Mm-hmm.
And I was watching a lot of Varda and reading a bit about her, and suddenly I just had this flash of insight that I recognized all of these tools that she used that I had also employed in a variety of disciplines, not just in film. And then I hadn't really thought of how to put them together in the way that she had. So she taught me through example what those tools could do. And so I made a film using all those tools that looks very kind of structurally very much like Varda. They're very similar approaches, but it's if Varda was a gay man who grew up in Cornwall, Ontario, she would have made this film, or let's hope. She would have made a much better version of this film. I don't want to presume that I have the talent she has, but it's the same kind of style. I really feel like this film's a disciple of that approach.
I did think that there was an exploration of masculinity, which is why I was tying it back to the Facebook poem we had just been discussing. I'm also interested in the fact that you work in multiple art forms, in film and poetry. I think teaching creative writing is a form of creativity too. So tell us about the different forms and why you decide to work in the form you do. How do the art forms feed you as a writer and as a creator?
Well, yeah, you know, it's amazing to work across forms and be a teacher because I find I'm often borrowing from my film practice in order to help teach students about poetry. I always tell my students that poetry and film are the closest form because they're both image-based systems.
Mm.
So you're following how you pack, load, unpack an image. And the shot in a film, which is sort of the standard language, you build shots together, is like a line in a poem. You build lines together, and they're image-based shots and image-based lines. So really, the forms in so many ways are quite similar, right? So I find like I was saying earlier, I find that the genres are really just a collection of tools or approaches. And the more you lean into a particular kind of tool or approach, the more it looks like something we recognize that we've named X, Y, or Z.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like dogs, right? All dogs are dogs. We have this, but dogs really vary. A Chihuahua and a Siberian Husky are very different, but they have a set of characteristics that we call writing. And sometimes they manifest in a Chihuahua writing, and sometimes they manifest, right? I think that kind of I don't pick a genre. Things just manifest in a way where the genre presents itself because of the type of tools that I need in order to do the best job to tell this or that story.
Mm.
So the first poem in this book you could say is a poem because it looks like a poem, but it's actually a story that I told. So maybe it's a spoken word poem, or maybe it's an oral history because it is a history of my family.
Mm.
Or maybe it is just a plain story. It's all of those things. And in a way, maybe you could say it's none of those things because it hasn't decided.
Or all of those things.
Right? You know, all of those and none of those. And it becomes a bit arbitrary at some point to decide whether whether it is this thing or that thing. And this, I think my film is film because, you know, it looks like a movie and you watch it in a theater.
Mm.
But it is also a poem. I built it the same way that I would build a long poem. I used all of the skills to make long form writing to make this movie too. In a poem, ideally, you generate a lot of extra material
mm-hmm.
to make a long poem, and then you edit it down into something tidier.
Sculpt it to bring in another genre or another art form.
Yeah, it's like collage. I'm crazy about any kind of collage, really.
Huh.
I like sewing because you put different pieces of material together. I like poems because you put different images and lines together. I like stories because you put different perspectives together. Maybe different ideas. I like film because you put different shots together. All of it's very similar. It's all a form of puzzle making where you stitch different things together to try to capture a complex idea that you communicate to somebody else.
Michael, you were referring to that first page. Might I ask you to read that first page for the listeners? I've read it a couple of times to my friends raving about your book. And I think
so sweet.
And I think it captures really well the tone that's often sustained. I'm going to come back to the tone, but I thought let's start with that first.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things I'm interested in is voice.
It's very clear you are. Yeah, you're pitching these different voices, different levels. And so I'll get you to read that first page and then we'll discuss that.
Okay, well, the first poem is called Grandma Cooper's Corpse. Here's how this story show works. I have a magic story bag, and every day I draw a card with a title on it. Today we drew Grandma Cooper's Corpse, which is a fucking whopper, because it's hard to talk about your grandmother's corpse, though it is good to learn new things. It doesn't matter how pretty you are, you always have more to learn, because pretty doesn't last. Michael taps forehead. Brains do.
I love it. Thank you. So I found that the poetic voice is often, it fluctuates, it's modulated, it's often ironic or comic or playful or whimsical. And then you hook the reader with that tone, and it's sustained until about one-fifth of the way in. And then there's, for me, a discernible shift. So I experienced it like a punch to the gut.
Well, that's nice.
It
You're
is.
You're my perfect reader, Linda.
I feel so happy that I have your perfect reader.
I feel so seen.
At that point, we learn about the poet's uncle, Uncle Bob, who is one hell of a guy, speaking of masculinity and toxic masculinity. So what he does is he asks the poet to take their book apart until it's nuts and bolts. And so we could probably read that passage too. This is on page 19 of your text. It's about midway through with the so.
So I started to freak out. I broke into a sweat and squeaked, "I don't know how to do this." Bob answered, "That is your first lesson then. Pay attention," and walked away.
So it's a moment of actual cruelty in my mind that he's not trying to teach him, actually. He's experimenting with how to be cruel.
With it was a complex bullying episode.
That's how I experienced it when I read it.
Yeah.
So the humor runs very thin by that moment. Tell us about the kind of the way that you're experimenting with tone and humor and so forth.
You know, it's funny because because I guess this was a storytelling show, I was trying to be entertaining. I was trying to draw the listener in.
Which you do.
And I was at home too, right? So I'm really talking to a computer. I was talking to a little green dot on my computer screen. But I knew that people were going to be listening. And I knew I was probably talking to my people. Right? Who's going to watch my storytelling show? Well, in a lockdown, it's going to be my family and my dear friends. So I had a sense of intimacy. I was performing a kind of intimacy. I imagined that my people were out there listening. So I think that accounts for some of the humor, but I didn't recognize how much humor was in it.
Oh.
And I had, it's funny, because I had a half of this poem, because I did two storytelling pieces, I first only transcribed one and then the poem came out in a little chapbook that a friend produced. It's Claire Thiessen, who runs Broke Press. She got a really nice little press out of the Okanagan. And she put a very kind of ghostly, ghouly, wiggly, comedic cover on that chapbook. And at first I was really horrified. I thought it was just a terrible choice. But I trusted her, so I just let it run its course. And I realized that what she was doing was picking up on the humor that was in the poem that I didn't see from the outside as much, because I am telling a story about my grandmother's death. And that was really smart, because it was a great framing device to enter into this, to invite people to look at this poem with a kind of humor or joy, to sort of lift it up, and then you let the hard stuff hit harder. But if we'd have started, if you know, if it was Grandma Krupa's corpse and there was a body or a casket on the cover and it was all black, we might have entered into it expecting something dark, and then the darkness doesn't hit so well, right? There's the an exercise or a lesson in contrast there.
Right. So there are two functions. There's the hook, which is why I've been reading that first page to so many people. It's so good. It really lures the reader in. But it also serves as that kind of contrast. So that moment when we reach him, page 19, and I felt it like a punch, that's when I know that this is a really effective tool because it creates that kind of marked contrast.
Well, and in some way, that's relationship. We meet people on the street and we say, hello, how are you? I'm fine. I'm good. And it's only an hour into the conversation that you find out, my mother died yesterday, or I'm dealing with, you know, whatever ailment, or I'm approaching the poem as a sort of entry into a relationship with the reader. You don't want to telegraph right from the beginning how dark it's going to get, because they might not come with you along for the ride. Mm. But that's the honeymoon phase of any relationship, right? And you
right.
get married really quick so that you get the for better or for worse, and then you
deal with the worst later.
And then the worst comes later. So yeah, it's that kind of thing. I'm interested in the especially long form. It's the marathon. You want to have some variety, you want to have some texture, and you want to ease people into the dark stuff to help them just be ready for it in a way, right? You can't go for the hard stuff right away because that pushes people out and it makes them close down because it's too frightening. You need to gain a little trust.
Which you do. You gain our trust. There's also a particular kind of vulnerability that marks these poems, a kind of candor, right? And it's at times raw, at times vulnerable. What's the decision-making that goes behind such vulnerability?
Well, this is something that people ask me because
I'm not the first.
Well, it's the first time anyone's asked it about this book.
Okay, whoops.
I'm naked in my film quite a bit, and I'm not comfortable with my body. So there's a kind of bravado, or I call it conviction. Mm. It's just something that I'm really good at. Candor is a skill I really have in the
bag. It is a skill. It's a skill.
And that's because it's been such a good reciprocal feedback loop. The more I've been vulnerable in my life, the more people have been vulnerable with me. And the more I have given of myself, the more generous other people are. This is coming back to the idea of my dad and his version of masculinity. I think this is why he suffered so much, is because he was taught that to be a man, which was his only option to be a human, was to be stoic, reserved, and unavailable. And so he was profoundly lonely and disconnected and died with very few people in his life and very little in his life. I packed up his apartment, and it was one of the hardest things I've ever done, to just see how somebody at 63 could have so little of anything. So few mementos, so few furniture, so little food. Like, he really lived on the edge. And I am quite sure that that was because he was not capable. You know, it's all the systems of power that gave him this right. narrative that he took within himself, but it kept everybody away and he had no help. So I partly learned by counterexample, but I also had people who were generous with me growing up. And that was always a really great feedback loop. And I saw it in my art. Years ago, I wrote a poem about my last night drinking. I've been sober for 25 years. And it's a terrible story about being too drunk, hitting on everyone at a party and humiliating myself, then walking the streets of Vancouver and crapping my pants and finding out I crapped my pants. And then I went to the park and I cruised for sex. That's more or less the poem. So it's really dark and it's really ugly and it's about the worst night of my life.
And yet it's also strangely funny.
It's funny. Who hasn't pooped their pants? And after I would read that poem, it didn't matter where I read it. I read it at the Vancouver International Writers Festival, and I read it all over. And every time I read that poem, someone came up to me and said, I pooped my pants too. And it just helped me feel less alone in that experience. And it helped them feel less alone. That's why they felt compelled to tell me, because they didn't want to be alone in that experience. And that kind of reciprocal generosity follows me through my life. And that's what teaching is. This is why I love teaching. It isn't about any kind of ego trip. Or maybe the ego trip is I like being of service. But I really love giving to my students. And they give me all kinds of affection and insight and wisdom back, right? We're in a reciprocal loop of sharing our best selves with each other and trying to make a better world through that sharing, whether that means a better poem or a better story or a better understanding of what a poem or story could be or has been, or more wisdom in the things that we're writing about, which is what compels us to write, is to find more wisdom in our experience. Students teach me all kinds of things all the time, and that is just generosity. In a way, you could call that candor, too. It's also something we have to do as teachers, certainly in creative writing, maybe not in math or even in English, but I need to model a certain vulnerability if I'm going to ask my students to also be vulnerable on the page or in the workshop. If they're going to write about hard times and then have a workshop where they have to navigate other people talking about their hard time, well, that takes a certain amount of bravery and candor, and I need to model that for them first. I need to be the most vulnerable person in the room in order to allow them permission to be their most vulnerable person too.
I find this amazing that you're speaking about vulnerability as a form of bravery, candor as a form of bravery, right, in relation to your father who was so disconnected, and that yet that's the model for masculinity. Toxic masculinity is explored in this collection. I wonder if you could talk about a couple of poems that treat that theme.
Yeah, well, we've referenced this poem, The Grandma Cooper's Corpse, with my Uncle Bob, who bullied me. There's a variety of stories in there about how he bullied me. He also bullied me with a Doberman pincer, who was really aggressive, and he threatened me with her on many occasions, but I describe one of them in particular. There's a poem in here that talks about childhood sexual abuse with my father, and it's an imagined poem of what would happen if I ever met the person who abused my father. And then there's poems from my own childhood bullying, somebody who called me a nasty word in an ethics class, and somebody who banged my head on a desk, but the teacher gave me a hard time because I
made a
squawking sound rather than asking the student why they hit my head.
It's a moment where I was both horrified and thought, why is the teacher punishing Michael or Michael's persona rather than the student who was engaged in bullying? But that often is a thing where the bully is supported.
They're more charming. They're more popular. The kid who called me a nasty name in my ethics class, his dad was the vice principal.
Oh.
He was the counselor and then the vice principal at the school. So nothing happened with that. It's really that's one of the things that I'm sort of trying to capture in. I don't want to point fingers and say, you know, you're a bad person, but maybe a little bit.
It doesn't come across that way, but it does point out the dynamics of power.
It. Yeah, that's it. I'm very interested in the dynamics of power. That's the nugget right there. I'm really interested in how we move through the world and how power works moving through the world, because I've seen it writ large and small. I've seen what Canada's Free Trade Agreement did to my hometown and my father and mother economically. Like, I've seen that power in politic. And I've also seen power in the bully in the classroom and the teacher who does nothing about it. Like, those are, in many ways, power's power and bullying's bullying, whether it's a corporation bullying or a country bullying us, you know, right? One of the things that I'm interested in unpacking the very minutiae of my own experience is I'm interested in nuance. I'm not interested in the stereotype of what it means to be a queer person or a queer man or a white queer man. I'm interested in the nuance of what it was like to be me in this very particular time and place. Because I think the more we understand nuance, the more we understand that the world isn't black and white, the more we lean into contradictions and shades of gray and not knowing and being two things or three things at once, that poetic and. The way we understand a poem, there's 15 people in a room, there are 15 versions of what that poem means, and all of those things are true. And so poetry has this great capacity to be all of those things at once, the poetic and. And that's plurality, multiplicity, polyphony. That's also nuance. That's also getting at the minutiae of experience and recognizing that all experience is valuable. I don't want to say useful because that sounds like it's so capitalist, but that all experience is wisdom and teaches us something, that we are these complex creatures. Mm. And the more binary we are, the more we're left and right, the more we're black and white, the more we get into a very entrenched way of understanding the world. I never understand it. We had a lot of fighting going on in the queer community around gay marriage. There were people who said, you know, gay marriage is terrible because we're just the whole marriage idea is an outdated form, and we should form families much more radically. You live with your mother and take care of her. Well, why is she not on your benefits package? Mm-hmm. You know, she's a dependent, that kind of thing. So there were all these arguments, and I was like, well, I don't understand why it's one or the other. Mm-hmm. Marriage is a good thing, and it can also be a bad thing. It depends on how we use it and what we're investing and what the consequences of it are. But there's no throwing this out and replacing it with a different kind of fascism. Like, the stereotypes are there to help us. Language is a kind of stereotype, right? Language is a kind of reductive way of communicating to help make us understand each other better. And I think poetry and art is trying to get us back to the kind of pre-verbal idea, trying to get back to knowledge that is complex and nuanced and not reductive. Poetry is pushing against the singular idea, right? So that
I want to stand up in a chair and cheer. I think that's exactly what it's trying to do. That's right.
Yeah.
I was interested in that point about marriage and the different forms that relationships could take, and that it doesn't have to be and or. I was thinking that I actually do research on the author Jane Rule. And Jane Rule was actually vehemently against marriage, but only because she thought that couples would inhabit a very limited space. And I think the kind of idea of marriage that you're proposing, or range of relationships you're proposing, is precisely what she would have advocated. It's that kind of openness. Why are we limiting ourselves in so many ways?
Right. Absolutely. 100%.
So speaking of Jane Rule, now I want to talk a little bit about perhaps important literary influences for you. Who are some of your most important literary influences?
Well, I guess the first two people who I found, who I took on as my people, were Bronwyn Wallace.
Oh, yes.
The great Kingston poet.
Not a lot of people know about her work.
I just adore her. I love her poems. I teach her poems all the time because they're so conversational. There's so many. Talk about range of voice.
Yes.
They sound academic sometimes and then deeply feminist, but still standing at the water cooler or on the corner or in the flower bed. They're very domestic and at the same time deeply political. So I found her when I was quite young, when I was in my teens in high school. And I was living in Cornwall and she was just up the road in Kingston. So I also had that kind of geography, right, that really spoke to me. It felt like she felt like some – I knew who she was writing about because they were my neighbors. And Lorna Crozier is other great love.
Yeah.
I found Lorna first, and I think I found Bronwyn sort of following Lorna's trajectory. Mm-hmm. But I read all of their books. Bronwyn passed away, unfortunately, but I read all of her books, and I've been following Lorna's career ever since and forced her to become my friend.
I'm sure there wasn't much arm twisting involved in that.
Well, and the thing I loved about Lorna is that she had such her poems are so accessible. They're really easy, kind of on the surface, you know exactly what the poems are about, and that yet her metaphors are so rich. She has all this density that's also there, or this sort of deep wisdom that she embeds in a poem. So, yeah, those are my first two loves that I still carry with me.
All right. And now that you are influential.
Oh, geez.
What would you like to say to those writers you are influencing?
Oh, man. Choose someone badder. Well, you know, I'm going to tell you a thing that I wished I had learned sooner. And that brings us back to the idea of memoir. When I wrote my memoir called My Body Is Yours, I knew what the story was, obviously, because it was the story of my life. And so a big part of the writing project for me was finding out how to write this book to sound like my best self. How can I be intimate and vulnerable without being syrupy? How can I tell people things that terrify me without, you know, without traumatizing my reader, without feeling like it's TMI? Sometimes I know some content might be TMI, but there's also a kind of lack of familiarity of what it's like to be a gay man, right? And I noticed this, like even in the people who really like me in my writing community, there aren't that many straight writers who've actually read my books.
That's peculiar.
Gay people read my books, but I noticed this living in Vancouver. Straight people wouldn't come to my gay movies. They wouldn't come to my gay performances. They wouldn't come to my gay book launches. And in fact, just recently, maybe 4 years ago, I was in Toronto for a reading and I was talking to a writer friend of mine and said, gee, I wonder if any writers are going to be coming. I know all these straight writers in town. They was like, no straight writers are going to come to the gay bookstore for a gay reading. I was like, what are you talking about? And sure enough, there were all kinds of people I thought might be there and none of them were there. And my friend just looked at me and said, yeah, well, they never come. They don't come to things. They don't come to gay things. And so I was trying to think of how do I draw as many people in to that memoir as possible and how am I going to be my best self in this memoir? And everything I've written since then has felt like a real like that book was a watershed. And I don't know if everybody would notice it reading my books because it's still me writing them. But I kind of gave up trying to sound like a poet. I gave up trying to sound like somebody else. I think I was pitching. We have a phrase. There's a phrase for talking white, right? That the black community learns how to function in an educational institution by talking white. There's only one way. There's the mainstream establishment way of using language, and you need to use it this way. I certainly noticed it as a blue-collar guy in the institution. My family swears a lot. There's swear words in my book because that's just how we talk. And the swear words sound worse in a university setting than they do at home. No one cares when I say some, you know, fuck or shit at home.
Yeah, yeah.
But they really do when you say it in the hallway of the university. There's a kind of bristling with some people. All that to say,
that's interesting.
I noticed suddenly that all the work I had made, I was trying to sound like an established poet rather than trying to tell the best story I could with the most integrity for my own character. So my advice for any writer who's starting out, I had heard this advice that you need to find your voice, but that wasn't good enough. It wasn't clear enough advice for me.
Well, I always think, where is that? Is it under my bed?
Well, this is it. And I think the advice is don't try to sound like anyone else. Don't do yourself the disservice of thinking that the way you call your bestie on the phone and tell them what terrible date you had last night isn't a great way to write a poem. I get all my students in my poetry class. I teach a second year poetry course. And the first thing we do is I tell them, call somebody up, tell them some fun story of what happened on the weekend that's like a short-ish story, like something that's going to take you less than 5 minutes, and record it and then transcribe it and shape it. And that's your first poem. It's a verbatim poem.
Wow.
And those poems are usually the best thing they write all year because it sounds like them. And they're not trying to write about love, and they're not trying to write about, you know, these abstract ideas, because so many people learn that a poem is William Shakespeare or Elizabeth Barrett Browning, whatever, and they are always trying to sound like somebody else who writes a poem rather than sound like themselves telling the story of what they know from their immediate experience in the language that they use every day. That language is compelling. Because language even on a street is different. Jeff Dewey didn't sound like me, and neither did Mark McGregor, and neither does my sister even. Everybody has their own way of talking, and your job as a writer is to try to sound like your best self, your truest self, telling whatever it is that you're telling. It isn't to try to sound less like yourself because you want to sound like somebody else. Mm-hmm. Yes, you might pull tools from other people, but don't pull voice from other people unless maybe your voice is limited and you're trying to find more range. Yes, right? But there's that difference between modeling and modeling strategies or approaches or tools that you're trying to learn to make part of your mm-hmm. own, rather than denying who you are, how you talk, what you know, how you communicate the things that you do know. And I think that's – I'm so convinced that everybody has talent and everybody is capable of being a great storyteller. It's just we give some people more space and credit to do so, and some people love it more than others. There aren't a lot of boring dinner parties when people get when people get a little drunk, right? Everyone knows how to talk. The boring dinner parties are the ones where people are reticent and reserved. Again, it's the same idea of generosity. You need to be generous with your people and trust that what you know is interesting to people on the outside of your brain and your heart and your body and your, you know, your senses. It's like radical inclusion. Everybody is welcome and everybody belongs. And if that's true, then everybody's story and version is legitimate. Some might be more true, factually true, right? I might not want to believe everything Trump says. Some things might be more factually true, but everyone's version of their story has a kind of integrity to it.
Michael, thank you for your radically inclusive, generous, compelling, unique voice, poetry, your interview. Thank you so much for being with me today on Getting Lit with Linda.
Thanks, Linda. This was amazing.
And that was my interview with Michael V. Smith. Please join us in the next episode, for which I interview Bryn Turnbull about her novel, The Paris Deception, a work of historical fiction that focuses on female artists during the Second World War. Until then, thank you as always for listening, my dear listeners.
That was Getting Lit with Linda, hosted by Linda Mora. If you have a topic you would like to hear covered, write to us at gettinglitwithlinda@gmail.com. Until next time, we hope you continue to get lit.